Proverbs. Today we're talking about your money and the knowledge of the Holy One as we continue our series of sermons on worship, wisdom, and work. Gaining the wisdom to work out our worship of our Holy God, responding rightly to Him in all of life. In Proverbs chapter 8, we said that wisdom involves being able to connect everything in life with Jesus Christ. If you're not able to make that connection, you're not wise. And so we've been looking at what Proverbs has to say about a whole lot of areas of our lives. Jesus is the revelation of God to us, and we want to know Him and to make Him known with our money. And yes, money is what we're talking about today. But I should clarify this right away. When I say money here for the purposes of this sermon today, I am really speaking about to represent everything that we talk about when we talk about economics. Now, when I say economics, however, I don't want you to get in mind these wonks up there talking about things like futures on Wall Street and congressional budget office projections. Or all those kinds of things that we sometimes associate with economics. In reality, economics simply has to do with the everyday activities of producing, using, exchanging, and giving material goods. Producing, using, exchanging, giving. That's what we do every single day. And that's what economics is about. That's something every single one of us does. It really is us acting in our role as sons and servants of God, created to steward God's good world for His glory. That's what we're doing. We don't, for the most of us, we don't need to know the arcane details of economics in order to know how to know Christ in this realm of our money. But we do need to have wisdom in it. The goal of all of our economic activity is to know God and to make Him known. Now, why do I say that? Because that's the goal of human life. And we participate in that life through our producing, using, exchanging, and giving material goods. And so with that goal in mind, then we can ask ourselves these questions and enter into the book of Proverbs for some answers. Are we building virtue? Or we could just say Christ-likeness through our economic activity. Are we demonstrating that we seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness in all of our producing, using, exchanging, and giving? Furthermore, how do we set our affections on things above, where Christ is, when we live very much on this earth dealing with all of these things like money? I believe Proverbs helps us to gain the wisdom we need to answer those questions. And I want to divide this overview of what Proverbs has to say about your money and the knowledge of the Holy One into two main areas. First of all, God's perspective on money that comes through in the book of Proverbs, and then participating with God with your money that comes through in the book of Proverbs. So first of all, God's perspective on money that we gain from the book of Proverbs. According to the book of Proverbs, wealth is, first of all, good. Now, that might sound a little bit surprising, but it's important to start there. Wealth, material goods, riches, whatever you want to call that, is a good thing. God made this. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 22. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 22 says this: "The blessing of the Lord makes rich, and He adds no sorrow with it." The blessing, the life-giving favor of the Lord. What does it do? It makes rich, and He adds no sorrow with it. In fact, the Lord rewards people with wealth. As 22 verse 4 says, "The reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life." Woman Wisdom herself, we went through chapter 8, says, "Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness." In fact, just to add one more text here, 14 verse 24 says, "The crown of the wise is their wealth, but the folly of fools brings folly." You see, you can't read the book of Proverbs very long without recognizing that Proverbs has nothing against wealth. We also need to be careful, though, as we enter into this and read the book of Proverbs, that we understand what it's talking about when it talks about wealth. It's not talking about, we usually think, I'm not wealthy, somebody who's a millionaire is. And we make it relative in those terms. Really, riches, wealth, is any of your produce. What makes life abundant? The things that you make and do, if you have those things, then you have, to one degree or another, wealth. If you lack those things, the needs of life, then you are poor. And so, wealth is just all the stuff of life. The stuff of life. And Proverbs is very clear that that can be good. God made this world good, and He gives it to us. In fact, the Lord grants wealth as a means of honoring Him. Because chapter 3, verses 9 and 10 says, "Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine." God blesses with wealth, with material goods. Wealth comes from diligent labor. God blesses diligent labor with wealth. As it says in chapter 13, verse 11, "Wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it." Or Proverbs 28, verse 19, "Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits will have plenty of poverty." Working your land, engaging in productive labor. And what does God make His world to do? So you see, what we're seeing in Proverbs is really just the natural way God has made His world to work. The way God created it, the way God governs it and upholds it and brings it to a appointed end. He made it productive, didn't He? It's not sterile. You plant a seed, and guess what happens? It's not just that a seed comes back up. It actually multiplies. It grows and brings forth 30, 60, 100 fold. It's an amazing thing. How did God make a world that keeps doing that? But that's what He did. He made a world in which productive wealth is a good thing. Now, Proverbs is fully aware that in this sinful world, the righteous may be poor, and hard work can be swept away through injustice. Yet the basic point still stands that wealth is a gift from God. It is the natural outcome of righteous living, and it is good. We mistake our view of the world if we don't start there. And the vantage point that Proverbs, I think, upholds. Wealth in and of itself is a good thing. We should receive it as a gift from God. But of course, Proverbs doesn't stop there, does it? Wealth is also a limited good. It is good. It is a blessing. And by the way, if you've ever seen or been to anywhere in the world where there is crushing poverty, you see what a good thing wealth is. There are just huge blessings that flow to us from the stuff of life that we have. But it is a limited good. And Proverbs makes this very clear. Chapter 3, verses 13 through 15, we read this. "Blessed is the man who finds wisdom, and the man who gets understanding, for the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her." So already we've seen, well, wealth is good, but now there's something better. Woman Wisdom, whom I quoted just a minute ago, saying that she gives riches, also says in the next verse, "My fruit is better than gold, even fine gold, and my yield than choice silver." So now Wisdom says that she is better than gold. In fact, we read through Proverbs and we find there are many things in life, many things, particularly character qualities, that are more valuable than riches. They are a greater blessing, in part because they are longer lasting and more effective. They are better long term, and even they have even eternal effects. For instance, Proverbs 22:1, "A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold." Or 28:6, "Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a rich man who is crooked in his ways." Okay, is it good to be rich? Sure. But there's something better than that. A poor man who walks in his integrity. And just consider this powerful text, chapter 15, verses 16 and 17. "Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble with it. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fattened ox and hatred with it. It's better for you to be living off of what you can graze from the field, so to speak. If you're able to sit down to that table with loving relationships there, than to dine in the palace of a king where there is hatred and enmity and strife. This is better. So, just think of the things we've already mentioned here. Wisdom, understanding, a good name, integrity, the fear of the Lord, love. These are all things that are better than riches, according to the book of Proverbs. And it's when we forget this, when we get our priorities out of order, that we turn money into an idol. We must never forget that righteousness is better than riches, far surpassing riches in its value. And that directs then how you invest your energies in your life, doesn't it? How you use the productive labor that God has given to you. He's made you as one of His image bearers to engage in this kind of dominion of the earth. But how do you invest those? Well, keeping this perspective helps you to invest those well. You see, Proverbs is clear. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Do not weary yourself to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist, Proverbs chapter 23 says. When your eyes light on it, it is gone, for suddenly it sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. And it reminds us in chapter 27, verse 24, riches do not last forever. Why are all these other things I just mentioned better than riches? Because they endure. Riches are fine. They're good. They're part of God's good world. They're things we use to accomplish God's good purposes. But they pass away. They go away. Proverbs reveals the same wisdom, ultimately, I believe, that Jesus Himself taught us when He said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on this earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal." And Jesus went on to say, "Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Your heart, your value system, the core of your being, what you're oriented toward, your ambitions and your desires and your loves and your trusts. That's where your heart is. Is it set on riches, or is it set on the kingdom of God? You see, this is the wise perspective on money that Proverbs gives us, by which we know God and make Him known. And that leads me then to just bring out a little bit here of what Proverbs teaches about participating with God, with money. Okay, this is a good gift from God. He's given it to you. He actually blesses people with this. When you labor, God blesses, and you acquire things. You acquire material possessions, and that's good. But it's seeking something better. So how do you begin to use it well? You might ask, how do I do this now? How do I seek the kingdom of God first and His righteousness, actually even in and through all the stuff of life, the material goods that we produce and use and exchange and give? Really, our money is a great test of where our heart is, isn't it? It shows a lot about where our heart's at. And so Proverbs gives us some wise guidelines how to work out our worship with our money. Not our worship of money, but our worship of God with our money. Let me just mention a few things that are very basic, but I hope you'll see how crucial they are to participating with God, to knowing Him and making Him known with our money. First of all, a major theme in the book of Proverbs in relationship to our material goods is this: be honest. Be honest. Be a man of integrity. Over and over and over again in the book of Proverbs. In fact, if I was to try to pick one theme that perhaps has the greatest number of Proverbs related to it, relationship to our material goods, this might be the one. I didn't actually count how many Proverbs are related to this. But this is a huge topic in the book of Proverbs. Be honest, be a man of integrity. Proverbs 10:2 declares this: "Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death." treasures are good. Treasures gained by wickedness don't profit. But righteousness delivers from death. Whoever is greedy, chapter 15, verse 27, whoever is greedy for unjust gain troubles his own household, but he who hates bribes will live. A person of integrity, a person of honesty. Chapter 14, verse 2, whoever walks in uprightness fears the Lord, but he who is devious in his ways despises him. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If you're going to walk in honesty and integrity, then you're the kind of a man who fears the Lord. If you're going to be devious in your ways, even in your producing or using, exchanging, and giving of material goods, you show that you don't fear God. You actually despise Him. You don't care about God if that's the way you treat your material goods. Here's one question I thought of that would perhaps help us to unpack. Are we people of integrity and honesty in all of our material dealings, our financial dealings? Would you be embarrassed to have your fellow Christians see your books, so to speak? And of course, I mean more than just your checkbook. I'm talking about your material dealings. Would you be embarrassed to have your fellow Christians see that? Would there be things there that you would say, you know, I'd really rather nobody knew about that. We'll keep that kind of quiet. Maybe that's an indicator that there's a conscience there saying, not all is integrity here. Not all is being honest and forthright. That's a good test for us as we consider. We want to know God. We want to follow Him. Okay, use your money in ways that are honest, honorable, and full of integrity. Make sure that's the case. That's much more important, according to Proverbs, than a profit. You engage in a business deal, of course you engage in it to make a profit. And that's a good thing, by the way. God designs that. Those who blindly attack profit as if it's a bad thing in business don't understand God's economy. But is that the end goal? No. And when it becomes that, and we start shading things and shaping things to make sure we get the profit over the integrity and the honesty, that's when we're falling prey to a false god, turning away from God. So be honest. Be a man of integrity. A second teaching of Proverbs about participating with God with your money is simply work hard. This is a good thing that God has given to you to do. And it's part of how you enjoy life with Him. Work hard. A slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame. Proverbs 10, 4 and 5. The hand of the diligent makes rich. There is a natural cause and effect in this world, because that's the way God's character is reflected in the world that He made and that He governs. And so when you work hard, you're participating with Him, and that works toward bringing results. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, 12:11 says. But he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty, 21 verse 5. Simple, plain, everyday, hard work is God's good gift to us by which we can participate with Him in His world. That's a good thing. In fact, Proverbs 14:23 goes on to say, in all toil there is profit, but mere talk tends only to poverty. In all toil there is profit. This is valuable in and of itself. Even apart from the profit motive, we might say, there are good things to simply working hard. God has designed His world that way. And so today, a challenge from Proverbs to you is learn to love hard work. Sometimes we tend to dread it, as if that's part of the curse. You know, and truly the curse following Adam's sin did make work wearisome to us. Did wear us out with work. But work in and of itself is a good thing. And we need to learn to look at the work of our lives that God gives to us as a good thing. Do you get up every morning dreading the work you have to do that day? Or do you think, thank you, Lord, that you've given me work to do, that I don't have the curse of having nothing to do today? That would be really bad for me. And it wouldn't be good for your glory either, if I simply had to sit in this room with nothing to do. God has given you work to do, and that's a good thing. In all toil, there is profit. Working hard is valuable. It's really a meaningful contribution to God's glory and to the good of others. Actually, you'll find this true. If you observe human societies, and we can study this sociologically or every way you want to look at it, that people who have meaningful work to do in life do better than people who don't. Which is one of the reasons why simple welfare handouts don't help people in the long term. They actually degrade them and make them less and less capable. But when people have good, productive work to do, when they actually accomplish something in life, I'm sure every one of you has experienced this in life. What are the things you learn to really enjoy? The things you feel like, I really accomplished something here. This was good. I toiled and I saw the fruit of my labor. And that's a blessing. That's enriching. It's good for God's glory. It's good for others' good. And that's what we should invest our life in. We shouldn't invest our life, on the other hand, of course, in what we already read, the proverb talks about worthless pursuits, which lead to poverty. And unfortunately, when we don't learn to love work, we start to invest our life in all kinds of things that don't work toward God's glory or others' good even. Some of the things we do are perfectly valid in themselves. Maybe playing games. Hey, is playing games a good thing to do? Sure it is. I think God has made us to be that kind of people, and I personally speculate, although I don't know this from the Bible, that we'll probably play games in the kingdom of God. I think there will probably be sports there. I think we'll still be running around doing all kinds of things. But when those kinds of things become the pursuit of our life, or the pursuit of a society as a whole even, what does that lead toward? It leads toward poverty. It doesn't build us up to know God. It doesn't build up others' good. We're not producing things that are good for others then. Working hard is valuable. In fact, we can ask ourselves, do you want your character to be formed so that you perceive God well? You want to know God and make Him known. Do you want your character to be shaped in such a way that you actually come to understand God's workings in this world? I mean, understand it more than just in a mental way, but where it's worked out into your heart and soul. You're going to have to work. That's just the way it works. Somebody can tell you things all day long, but if you work, you begin to perceive God better. It's very good for you to work. Work is valuable. Proverbs teaches us that. If you want to participate with God in relationship to your material goods, work hard. And learn to work hard in order to provide for yourself. That's God's plan. Don't have a welfare mentality which says, other people owe me stuff so that I don't have to work so hard. Related to that then, Proverbs also teaches us to prepare for the future. If we're going to use the material resources for God's glory and others' good, we need to prepare for the future. In Proverbs 31:25, just to pick out one text, speaking of the virtuous wife, this wife whose worth is far beyond any jewels, it says this of her, that she laughs at the time to come. She laughs at the time to come. Why is that? Is it a joke? No. What's the point? She has prepared well for her family, and therefore she's ready for whatever the future might bring. She has invested that labor, and she has reaped the benefits of her labor, and therefore she's prepared for the future. The ant gathers in the summer in order to be ready for the winter, according to Proverbs chapter 6. This is just the way it works in God's good world. And you need to be that way if you're going to work with God, participate with God in relationship to your material goods. Prepare for the future. This, by the way, is why I encourage people so much, just as a practical tool, you need to have a budget. And you need to operate by it. Something as simple as that is a good tool for helping us to do what Proverbs says to do. Use what God has given to us well. Work hard for it, and then use it well according to the objectives that God gives us for our lives, like providing for our families and other things. Budgeting does that. It trains us, by the way, also. It trains our desires. It trains our spending habits. So I'm not just, oh, that looks good, fork over the money, not considering what's going to come 2 weeks down the road, that, you know, you really do have a bill coming due and you better be ready for that bill. It's very simple, not difficult, and yet I've met so many Christians in my life, in my time even as a pastor, who will say, well, we don't really budget, or even, I don't have enough money to budget. And I tell people, you don't have enough money not to budget. In fact, the poorer you are, the more crucial this is, probably. If you're going to be a good steward of what God has entrusted to you, prepare for the future. Look at what's coming ahead. Think about the future. You see, this is important not merely from a financial perspective, but also even as an issue of character. And it's important not merely as an issue of character, but also as an issue of knowing God and making Him known rightly. If we're going to rightly represent God, I believe we need to have this kind of character. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 incorporates the same exact lesson when it tells us to work with your hands and not be dependent on others. That's important as part of your Christian witness. Do you know that? Christians need to be those kind of people who are hard workers, preparing for what comes up in their lives so they don't end up always looking to somebody else to get me out of this jam. Help me out here. I didn't prepare for this. Oh, I didn't think about that. Or I didn't save enough money for this. Or, you know, I went and bought that car and I didn't really think about the fact that that's not going to leave me with enough money to buy my groceries. And Christians shouldn't be like that. They should be preparing for the future if they're going to be rightly representing God. I would even suggest this, that easy credit is a terrible blight on our society right now. That buy now, pay later kind of a mentality, it really twists inside out God's way of working in this world. It's opposite to everything God teaches us about the way He works and about the way we ought to work in His world. No, you don't buy now, you pay later. You save now and buy later in God's economy. You work hard for what you need, and then you get it. You invest your own labor. That's even, without going too far afield here, part of the value of that. Easy come, easy go is the proverb we have. You ever notice how things you don't have to work for don't matter too much to you? And when you try to order your whole life in terms of what I don't have to work for but I can get now, suddenly, and almost paradoxically, nothing in life matters very much. It's all throwaway. It's not that valuable to you anymore. And the very things you thought you had to get right now to be satisfied end up not satisfying you at all. Versus the things you really did have to work hard for and really did have to invest a lot of labor and blood and sweat and tears in. Guess what you find out over the long term? Those things have some value to you because it's about much more than money, as Proverbs would have us to know. So, that's why I say easy credit is a terrible blight on our society. The whole credit card mentality that has come about. A terrible thing, really. Not just individually, but even as a society. And when even governments operate this way, as they are wont to do, then that again leads toward the path that Proverbs warns us against. This is particularly apropos, perhaps in this season in our society, which has become identified with buying a lot of stuff. December of every year after Thanksgiving is about buying a lot of stuff. And if you don't have the money for it, what do? You put it on the credit card or something like that. I think Proverbs would encourage that kind of, oh, but I'm doing it to give gifts to people. Is that really a wise way to go about being stewards of God's world? Perhaps if you don't have the money now, You shouldn't be paying for that in order to give it to somebody else. If God hasn't entrusted you with it, then it's not yours to give yet. Work for it. And then if God entrusts it for you, to you, go ahead and get it. But that's you see how we get things twisted around when we don't look at things from God's perspective. Proverbs teaches us, work hard, earn what you get, prepare for the future. And then, one other lesson from Proverbs regarding participating with God with our money, give generously. This too is something that frequently pops up in the book of Proverbs. Let me give you a couple examples. Proverbs 11:24. One gives freely, yet grows all the richer. Another withholds what he should give, and only suffers want. What would seem to be not true from a simplistic perspective, giving and yet growing richer. I've got to keep a hold of what I have if I'm going to get ahead, right? Well, Proverbs actually says, a wise person understands how giving is so crucial in this life. 14:21 says, it says this, blessed is he who is generous to the poor. Again, blessing, enjoying God's life-giving favor. Who is that man? The one who is generous to the poor. A generous person knows God's life-giving favor. These are all wise ways of participating with God in His good plan to build virtue. They're not rocket science, are they? You don't have to be a PhD in economics to get these things. But this is the way God's world works. And if we're going to use our money well, these are the kinds of lessons that we need to incorporate. And what they actually do, and here's the beautiful thing about them, when we use our money in these ways, it produces the things that are more valuable than money. Wisdom, understanding, love, the fear of the Lord, all those kinds of things, a good name. They keep our producing, our using, our exchanging, and our giving tied to the whole goal of life, which is to glorify and enjoy God. And that's what is really good for us. You know, folks, if we sever our money from that goal, that's when it becomes a terrible idol. And again, let me take just a couple minutes here to suggest some things in terms of the bigger picture of how this plays out in our lives. I've tried to draw out just these basic lessons from the book of Proverbs as something that every single one of us need to understand. But I think it's also helpful for us to start working at, as Christians, as God's people, in our world today, working out how this works into the bigger scheme of things so that we'll have wisdom in the use of our material resources. Everything we've just laid out from the book of Proverbs, I believe, stands in great contrast to the debt economy in which we live today. And the irony of it is to me that in our great wisdom, we have now begun to call virtues what God calls vices, and vices what God calls virtues. And we sometimes scorn a lot of ancient wisdom as if it didn't apply to us today in our market economy. They, after all, didn't understand the things that we now know. You know, they didn't understand you could have a growth economy. They thought economy was only static economies, and so, therefore, they thought, you know, these kinds of things were true. But now that we really know you can actually have growth economies, then, well, those things that Proverbs says don't really apply. Or those things that Christians in years gone by. We tend to think that kind of a way. For instance, Proverbs says that debt is bondage. Chapter 22, verse 7, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. Okay, that's a bit of wisdom from the book of Proverbs. The borrower is the slave of the lender. But what are we often coached to believe today? Borrowing is the way to get ahead, right? If you're really going to make it in business or lots of other ways in life, you start off by borrowing. And that's, you have access to credit. And that's what really gets you off your feet. And we even export this around the globe, by the way. This underwrites policies and relationships to other countries and how we're going to help NGOs and other places try to help in various countries around the world. There's a poor country here. Well, you know what they really need? They really need access to credit. If they had access to credit, then they could start their business and they could get ahead in life. Maybe there's more to the story than that, right? Proverbs says, the borrower is the slave of the lender. Last time I checked, being a slave wasn't really considered an ideal condition to be in, right? We don't really want to be there if we don't have to be. Now, by the way, the Bible recognizes that there are times when you end up in debt. The Bible never says debt outright is sin. But it never treats it as a good thing to be in. It's a bondage. Proverbs also teaches this, 28:8. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit, by what used to be called usury, gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. In other words, he's amassing all this wealth, and in the end, God is going to see to it that it really ends up in the hands of those who help others. How does this work? Well, let me try to play out something here and follow along with me. I believe that by our work, by the labor that God gives to us to do, we contribute to both our own and even to the people around us, our whole community's maturity. Again, in all labor there is profit. And the compensation then we receive for our work, which is good and what God has designed, can be put to use for the good of others, particularly for those with whom or for whom we have responsibility, but for the good of others. In fact, notice the contrast even in Ephesians chapter 4, where it contrasts, let him who stole no longer steal, but rather labor with his hands so that he can have stuff for himself, so that he can have to give. Right? That's the contrast it provides for us. A totally different perspective on what this is all about. Our work can be put to use for the good of others. But here's what can happen. If we separate the compensation from our labor, that is what we've invested in productive labor in order to receive a return for that, we separate that from the profit gained on investments, then we have severed the connection between money and the purpose of our lives. Why we really exist and what we're doing this for. It becomes money for its own sake. You see, we can gain profit, but our labor doesn't have to enter into it. And if our labor is removed from the equation, then we are removed from the purpose of making money. Why do we make money? So I can make more money. So I can have more stuff. What other purpose would I have for doing it? And really what happens in that kind of an equation is profit is all that is left, as if it were self-justifying, as if that was an end in itself. And that works against developing responsibility, loyalty, liberty, and all those good things that are character qualities that really are more valuable than riches. And that's why I believe that in our day of materialism, we as Christians need to resurrect and reconsider some historic Christian teaching regarding usury. I don't think we necessarily have to just say, oh, they were all right, but we need to think carefully about what was a long-standing Christian teaching of prohibiting usury. That is, Christians don't believe in usury. That is wrong. You shouldn't do that kind of a thing. Why did they do that? Well, prohibiting usury presupposes a particular kind of human relationships, a particular kind of human relationships based on love. And it challenges us deeply with regard to our covetousness, with our greed, with regard to our anxiety about the future. If I could put it in simplistic terms, the historic Christian position was something like this. Again, this is simplistic, but hopefully will help to communicate it. When loaning money, you may not require payment above and beyond what you have loaned simply because you have loaned somebody money. That would be usurious. That is, just the mere fact that you let him have some of your money and he's going to pay it back to you later doesn't give you any right to claim more money than what you've given to him. That would be, in a nutshell, what we're teaching. Now, there has to be then some other good reason. If you're going to say, well, you need to pay back more than what I gave you, you have to have some other claim to that. And they would say things like, if expenses are incurred due to loaning the money, then you can justly require that in return. Okay, it costs, for some reason, it costs you something to give this money to that person and have them use it and then pay you back later in kind. It could be just to say, well, it's going to cost me this much for you to use this money at this time. So, when you pay me back, you pay me back what I gave you plus what the cost was. Okay, that can be just, Christians would have argued. Also, they would argue, and this gets a little more complicated, that potential loss of income that would have come if the money loan had been otherwise invested could reasonably be charged. However, this is not guaranteed. You have to be able to demonstrate that you lost money by letting this other person use your money and not just assume it. So, for example, in time of economic recession, if a man were to loan another man some money and say, okay, you can have this money and then you pay me back at a later time, but I was going to invest this money in iron factory over here and I was going to get return from that labor and I don't have that money to invest in that now because you're using it, so maybe there can be a charge. However, if the iron industry is currently losing money in everything it does, then that man's going to have a pretty hard time proving that he's losing money by letting you use his money instead of investing it in iron. Okay? You see a little bit how that could work? He had to be able to show a reasonable case that he actually was losing the money if he's going to try to charge for it and say, well, I deserve that you pay me back for that. That was, again, very simplistically, a historic Christian position regarding usury and loaning money. Today, we tend to dismiss that as simply irrelevant to our modern economy. But I would like us to revisit that question as Christians and ask, is that really so? It seems that the Bible would have us to think about that a little more carefully before we dismiss this as simply irrelevant. And I think those who have thought about this can make an appropriate case. For example, economist Bernard Dempsey, 20th century, argued that modern economics are founded on what he called institutional usury. Not on a personal level, but just institutionally. It's the way it's set up to work is based on usury. And I suspect this, without going into all the ins and outs, and without even trying to lay an unreasonable burden on the consciences of God's people, but just encouraging us that, you know what, there's more to think about than just what we're handed by the world today in terms of how economies work. The Bible actually challenges us at a deep level about what life is all about and what we're using our money for and how we use that righteously for God's purposes. And I suspect that if the church is to present a powerful witness to our age, we need to be careful about what the world is teaching us about money. The way the early church in the book of Acts, for instance, used their money was a great testimony to the work of the Spirit. There's something going on here that's the work of God when people were generous and they were sharing, and the church was showing something powerful. I believe we have much to learn in our day and age, much that as Christians we need to stop and think about. But to come back to the primary important points of this sermon, God gives us in the book of Proverbs a crucial perspective on riches. It is good. God made his world to be productive. And that's a good thing. But it's not an ultimate good. It's a limited good. There are things in life that are much more valuable than money. And we should not toil to become rich. We're seeking greater things than that. The money is a tool. The money is a means to an end. And we want to use it for God's glory. Therefore, work hard. Be honest. Be people of integrity. Save. Prepare for the future. Don't buy what you don't have the resources to afford. Be generous. Those are being good stewards of God's good world, showing by doing that, that we're seeking first the kingdom and His righteousness.